Welcome to New Realities. This is Alan Steinfeld, and each week on this program, I look for what I feel is really at the cutting edge of consciousness, our evolution, our abilities as beings to perceive other realities. I call this program New Realities, and tonight's guest, I think, is someone who has investigated those realms in the form of synesthesia. We'll be talking about what synesthesia is and her book, Blue Cats and Chartreuse Kittens. Her name is Patricia Duffy. And Patricia, thank you for being here.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So what I know of synesthesia and is the blurring of the senses, and when I've read about it, everyone thinks it's a malady, when I think it's actually a very special gift that, you know, that all the poets and painters and all the creative people have in order to create art. They use that mixing of the senses in order to express more fully the reality they're living in. Would you say that? Or how would you define it?
Yes, I would. I would define synesthesia as a form of perception.
Mm-hmm.
And it's usually a blending of sensory experience where people might experience, for example, music as having colors and shapes.
Mm-hmm.
The painter David Hockney experiences music as having color, and he used that gift to create stage sets for the Metropolitan Opera. And sometimes his stage sets would have some very unusual effects, like blue tree trunks and red leaves, because those were the colors that he perceived in the music. So for some people, words have color. Numbers have color. This is what I experience. Every word that I hear just automatically has a color.
All the time. Who's saying it? Does it change with the...
No, it doesn't matter. It's just the word itself will always have a particular color, and it will never change.
Like, which words have what colors that stand out for you?
Oh, I mean, there are so many, let's see. What's your name again?
Alan.
Alan, okay.
Alan Steinfeld. Does that have a color?
Alan has a... Yeah, of course. Alan has, like, a nice dark orange color, like a sunset, like a very kind of a sticky, very bright orange sunset, like that.
You just see the color in front of yours and more like an internal sensing?
Well, you know, right now as you and I are talking, it's internal. You know, if you say your name, then your name will appear in my mind's eye in its particular colors. So it'll be a very, you know, dark orange A, and then a very kind of pale yellow L, and then another very dark orange A, and then a very dark N, dark brown N. But then the whole thing will tend to take on the color of the first letter, which is this kind of sticky dark orange sunset, and that color cast will be over your entire name. And this is, you know, this is just a very automatic response. I can't really change it, but it seems that the more neuroscientists study synesthesia, the more they realize that it's a lot more common than we thought. You know, when I was writing my book back in 2001, a study at Cambridge University said about 1 in 2,000 people experienced synesthesia.
Uh-huh.
And now, the more that it's been studied, University of Edinburgh and University of London has come up with a figure that it could be about 1 in 200. Maybe even 1 in 100.
I think everyone has it to some degree. They must, because
you're right.
They can relate to poetry, which uses a sort of synesthesic... Metaphors are synesthesic, in a way. I mean, I know I have
Absolutely.
It to some degree. When I see colors, particularly color combinations like black and yellow or silver and red... It stimulates a taste almost, or a sense, but it's not quite a taste. It's a sense that I can't really describe. It's more like a feeling sense. So it's something else, but I feel those things and I can almost taste it, but it's not quite a taste. It's more like a feeling taste. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean that sounds to me like a form of synesthesia, and I think what you said is you know, just before is absolutely right, that we all, to some degree, understand and experience synesthesia, and it's sort of on a continuum from maybe mild to very strong. Just the fact that our language is filled with so many synesthetic metaphors, and we all
like
understand
what
they mean.
Go
well,
ahead,
if I say, yeah, if I say, for example, you know, I have a friend who's always wearing such loud colors. We all immediately know what that means, even though I'm putting a sound word together with a sight word, right? Loud and color. We all know what that means. We don't have to be a, you know, a complete synesthete to know what that means. We all get it. If I say, you know, he's always wearing like hot pink when he should be wearing cool gray, we all know what that means too. So our language is so full of these that on, you know, on some level, we're all experiencing the world in a kind of cross-sensory way. For some of us, it just becomes, you know, who are maybe at the stronger end of the spectrum, it just becomes kind of more literal, you know, that maybe a particular word actually is gray for us or is hot pink for us.
It actually is. You and others actually see these colors and see the real. But why was it considered an illness for so long?
Well, you know, I think probably anything that is kind of unusual, that that maybe, you know, people in the mainstream couldn't sort of understand. Well, I don't experience that, so and most people I know don't experience that, so if this one person is experiencing it, there must be something wrong. You know, also they remember that for hundreds of years, scientists really had no way of corroborating the reports of synesthetes. You know, they had reports for centuries that some people were experiencing words as having colors. Sir Francis Galton, who was a 19th century scientist, used to collect reports of people who said words had color or music had color. He thought it was very fascinating. He didn't know what to make of it, but he thought it was very interesting. But it was really only in the 1980s, maybe the mid-1980s, that we began to develop the medical technology to look inside the brain and to do things like brain imaging and brain scans. And that enabled neuroscientists to see that something different really was happening in the brains of synesthetes.
And what is that? What is happening? Yes.
Okay, what's happening is that if a person who experiences colored word synesthesia, for example, if you do a brain imaging of that person and you read a list of words to them, not only the part of the brain that processes language will show activation, but also the part of the brain that shows responsible for color processing will show activation. So it means that there's a particular kind of cross-activation going on between the part of the brain that processes color and the part of the brain that processes the sound of language, so that you get this, the result is this kind of blended sensation where the sounds of the words have colors.
Right, and that doesn't, it's not true for all people, it's just synesthesiacs.
Well, yeah, it seems to be true for people who, you know, experience words as having color. You know, it's a very automatic response. They can't really change it. It's just the way it is for them.
Is that a miswiring or is it an evolution? I would think it's an evolution. It's a gift. I mean,
you know, there are different points of view about it. Some people see it the way you do. They think, well, this is a, you know, maybe this is another, you know, another stage in evolution. My own feeling is that, you know, what is evolution really about? It's really about diversity. It's really about creating lots and lots of diverse creatures and forms of life. And I think that nature is really after diversity. And it's, you know, no two of us are the same. And no two perceptions any human beings have are exactly the same. So I think that, you know, that synesthetes perceptions are just another form of human diversity. And you know, we need all kinds of people to make a world. We don't want a world full of only synesthetes, and we don't want a world full of only non-synesthetes. We want both to make a world.
No, I think everyone is a synesthete. I think there's a what my theory is just these people have somehow naturally developed a part of their brain that cross-references the senses, and I do think it's an evolutionary leap when these types of things occur. But have you noticed that for you, let's say, do people relate to the same colors, to the same words? Have you met people who see it the same way, or any two synesthesics alike?
Well, it's pretty idiosyncratic, I think, for each person. However, there are some mysterious commonalities. I know, for example, that there was a study at Cambridge University that said something like 92% of synesthetes will see three letters in the same color range. Almost all of them will say that O is white, they'll say that U is anywhere from the brown to yellow range, and they'll say that the letter I, is anywhere from the white to sort of silvery gray range. And no one can really explain why this is. There have been some more recent studies that say that lots of people will say that the letter A, lots of synesthetes will say the letter A is maybe red or orange. That's a very common response. So, you know, we don't really know.
What about in another language, though? If they speaking French, would A still be the same color?
That's an interesting question. You know, for me, they're basically the same color, but the shade of the color is a little bit different. If I think of French words, somehow the A is a little bit kind of light, like the orange A might be a little bit lighter and airier than an English A sound.
Right.
So, and I interviewed synesthetes. I interviewed, for example, a woman who was Russian, but she was also fluent in English. And she talked about how there was a sound in Russian that was sort of like an L sound, but not exactly. It was sort of like lya, but it was close to an L sound. And she said, well, in Russian, it's like a really soft pink, but in English, it's like a really tough, hot pink. So again, there was that sense of the shade of the color being a little bit different, you know, because of maybe the somewhat different pronunciation in the other language.
Oh, I see. That's interesting. But there are also sounds that also project images, like, you know, like shh. I don't know. For me, I get images. I think in images. So.
Oh well, there you go. What image does that have for you?
It has an image of water somehow. Like maybe it's
that's
this
very
association. Yeah. So yeah. I mean, there's been some famous synesthesiacs. Scriabin, right? The musician.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Talk about him because he.
Yeah, the Russian composer.
Yeah.
And he wanted to show. You know, he wanted to create a musical piece. He composed a piece called Mysterium. And he thought that music had lots of different aspects, not only sound, but also color and also even scent. And he thought that each musical note had a color and a corresponding scent. And when he composed Mysterium, he composed it for a color organ. He wanted the colors of the music to be projected onto the wall as the piece was playing, and he also wanted to fill the concert hall with different kinds of scents as the notes changed, because he thought, you know, this is the way for people to have a really full sensory experience of music. Music isn't just about sound. For him, it was also about color and about scent. And interestingly, you know, you mentioned, evolutionary aspect of synesthesia. Scriabin was a disciple of a very famous mystic, Madame Blavatsky.
Oh, was he a theosophist?
Yes, he was. Absolutely.
Oh, I didn't know. She was quite amazing, wasn't she?
She was amazing, and as you said, you know, she was the founder of theosophy, and
yeah.
She said that you know what she called sensitives, which meant that people with extra psychic ability were able to perceive every sound, every musical note as having a corresponding color. And she even had a whole color code for what this was. And her color code matched Scriabin's color sound correspondence. When he talked about the colors of his different musical notes, they matched Madame Blavatsky's color sound correspondence. So there has always been this for some people, this mystical association with synesthetic experience.
Well, there's also the story of the famous mathematician, the Hindu Indian mathematician who would see, feel numbers. Do you know about that guy?
No, I don't. That's interesting.
I'm looking for that example in the book Morning of the Magicians. He was a very famous mathematician and would come across some numbers he would just hate, like, you know, four-digit numbers, and then he'd come across others that were beautiful to him. Just the number themselves were just had a certain feeling. And I don't know, it's like, you know, 759 was a beautiful number for him or something. I have to find the exact paraphrase, but there's a whole story about him and his feeling of numbers. So
that's
numbers,
fascinating.
Yeah, I know.
You know, it's interesting because a Nobel Prize winning physicist, Richard Feynman, he won the Nobel Prize back in the 1960s, for him, in quantum physics, for him, mathematical equations had colors. And he said that when he would be teaching a class and he would try to describe his theories of quantum physics and he would be talking about equations, and he said that for him he had the experience of being surrounded by colored numbers and colored equations, almost as if, you know, mathematics for him constituted a kind of colorful environment, like a kind of three-dimensional environment. And suddenly as he was describing this, he would think, but my students aren't seeing it the way I am, so how can they understand what I'm saying? And this brings up a really interesting point that maybe, you know, what's the connection between the way in which we conceive of ideas, right, or visualize our ideas, and our ability to evolve those ideas? Would Richard Feynman have been able to evolve his ideas in the same way and come up with the theories of quantum physics that he did if he had not been able to perceive numbers and equations as having color or, you know, having this kind of spatial quality where he was surrounded by them and he was in this environment of numbers? Did that allow him in some way to evolve his ideas the way he did?
So there's this whole thing of creativity and higher levels of perception is where it's leading to, yes.
Exactly, yeah.
And so what does that say? Take that to, like, the next level, because how do we then evolve perception? How do we bring that out? And how do we, you know, create a more evolved culture from these kind of people, these pioneers of perception, in a sense, you know?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. You know, I think that, you know, in doing my research for my book, Blue Cats, I found that a lot of people told me, well, you know, when I was a child, numbers had color and words had color, but then when I got older, I kind of lost that, or I mentioned it to my parents or to my friends, and people said, oh, you know, what are you talking about? You're crazy. And I sort of just, like, forgot about it, you know? So, and then probably what happens to a lot of us is we start out with some very, full and maybe original perceptions, in the way we code language and the way we code music. But then we go to school and we learn this kind of standard shared way of coding language and perceptions. You know, we sort of learn this way of, okay, this is what words are supposed to look like. They're not supposed to have colors, but they're supposed to have these particular shapes, right, that are different letters, and they're supposed to look like this. And sometimes those original perceptions that we had that were very unique to us kind of fall away. But I think what's different maybe about synesthetes is that they retain those original perceptions that they had all by themselves before they learned those shared codes, you know, of smelling and you know, how things are supposed to look or be experienced. People sort of kept their own ways of doing it, of perceiving it. So I think if somehow we could encourage children maybe to focus on their own perceptions of things and not lose them when they, you know, we all need a shared code so we can communicate, but we don't want to lose our own special, unique, personal code. So I would say the more we can we can kind of get in touch and stay in touch with our own personal code, I think this would really further our development.
Well, I agree, and I think, you know, what children perceive at that age is really just an expanded reality, and then they've been conditioned and programmed to narrow that scope to something that perhaps we could, you know, that fit into a culture that's static and doesn't encourage creativity. If we could keep those perceptions, I think we would really live in a much more multidimensional world that really does exist. I think, you know, the world of the synesthesiacs is everyone's world, but they've narrowed out their vision. So to live in that kind of bigger universe is, I think, what evolution is about. That's what I'm hoping, and so I think your research is valuable in that way. It seems also like a lot of synesthesiacs somehow have a higher intelligence, would you say, than the average person? Or is that
not
true?
Well, I think there have been studies that show that in general they do. And also a really important study by Dr. Ramachandran, who's a wonderful, great neuroscientist at the University of California, San Diego, the Center for the Study of the Brain and Cognition. He and his colleague, Ed Hubbard, had done a study that showed that synesthetes are 8 times more likely to be in the creative professions, you know, than let's say people that don't identify themselves as synesthetes. So synesthetes were much more likely to be visual artists or musicians or writers, 8 times, or dancers, 8 times more likely than the average population. So it does seem to indicate something about, you know, the importance of retaining those that personal code.
Well, let's get back to that idea, because this is sort of the focus of the show. I mean, what I like to focus is this: if these things exist, if people are perceiving these, even as children, there must be a reality that exists of this world of colored letters. I mean, it's maybe not a truth, but it's a reality that seems to be there. I mean, right? I mean, it's something that other people, if they were allowed to, could relate to.
Well, you know, there's a researcher named Daphne Moorer who's studying synesthesia in children now. And her theory is that, you know, babies that are younger than the age of 6 months, we could say that, or maybe it's 4 months, we could say that all of them are synesthetes, because they're all experiencing the world as a kind of one undifferentiated whole. Their brains haven't developed to the point where they've separated the different functions, you know, the different sensory functions, like I'm seeing this, but I'm hearing this, but I'm touching this, but I'm smelling this. To the baby, you know, it's just all one whole. They're not making those kinds of divisions in their experience. So, you know, one theory of synesthesia is that as the brain matures and you know, compartmentalizes its functions, in some people this doesn't take place completely, and there are still some overlaps that remain between this part of the brain, that part of the brain, and so you might hear something, but it also makes you see something. You're still retaining that part of yourself that lets you experience the world as a kind of fusion. Or kind of, you know, something undifferentiated, that sound is sight and sight is sound.
Well, I know with some hallucinogenic drugs, it seems like those things get more pronounced. Have you studied that, effects of LSD on synesthesia and other psychedelics? Have you gone?
Well, it seems that people, you know, going back to what you said earlier, that maybe everybody has this capacity for synesthetic perception. But maybe in some people, the neural pathways that allow that kind of perception are only activated, you know, when when people take like psychotropic drugs like LSD or mescaline. In other people, those pathways may be sort of naturally activated, maybe because of, you know, early environmental factors, you know, that they were somehow more allowed to hold on to certain kinds of perceptions. And, you know, we know that experience does affect the way the brain develops physically. So maybe depending on the experiences a particular person has had, combined with, you know, maybe some genetic influence, that could be a factor too. You know, people's brains develop in one way or another. And we know that the brain has enormous capacity to develop in many, many different ways, even in a particular individual.
Yeah, no, just as you're saying that, I mean, we don't know that much about the brain. I mean, they can't explain idiot savants. Is there some relationship between, would you say, what some people can do as, you know, these amazing calculations and synesthesia?
You know, I don't know if there's like an absolute connection or correlation, but I do know that some of your listeners have read a really wonderful book called Born on a Blue Day by Daniel Tammet, who is a savant. You know, he's one of those people who's able to calculate. I mean, you know, if you say, okay, what day was, November 4th, 1876, what day of the week was that? Or if you ask him to make some very complicated calculation, he can do it very quickly. He happens also to experience synesthesia, which he writes about in his book, and he talks about the beauty of the colors of numbers. So it does seem to play a role for him. I mean, his synesthetic experience seems to play a role for him in his ability to do those kinds of amazing calculations.
Well, I'm just I found this reference to this guy, Ramachandran. You know him?
Ramachandran?
Yeah.
Is maybe the neuroscientist I was talking about?
Well, no, this guy lived in the early 1900s. His name is Ramanujan. He's still
Indian. No, I don't know him.
Yeah, he lived in this world of numbers, you know, that
everything. Really?
So we asked somebody what was the number of the license plate that brought it to him. He said, oh, it was 1729. And he says, what a wonderful number.
Uh-huh.
It's the lowest number that can be expressed in two ways as a sum of two Q's. But he just loved, I mean, he just knew stuff like that instantly. He would just, he'd sense the feeling of numbers. And
that's beautiful. I have to find out more about him.
It's in this book, The Morning of the Magicians.
Oh, I will definitely read this book, yeah.
Oh, it's an amazing book. It's talks about a lot of these unusual talents that people have and just unusual anomalies of our culture that go outside the boundaries. They talk about Charles Fort in here. You know who Charles Fort was? He was someone who studied newspaper articles and found very bizarre coincidences around the world.
Huh.
Like, you know, in five different cities there was a guy named John Smith that fell out of the fifth floor window on Main Street on the same day. You know, he put together these very strange coincidences.
That's fascinating.
So with all this, you know, the stuff you're talking about, there's a lot more to reality than we've been conditioned to think exists.
Yes, I completely agree with you there. Absolutely. I mean, I think we're kind of taught to focus our attention on certain things and to just dismiss other things, even if we, perceive and experience those things. They're not given any sort of credence or validation by the world, the society that we live in. So we're kind of, you know, our attention is like forced away from them. And this is sort of a pity because there could be a lot of beauty and creativity and potential in those things. You know, the mystic Evelyn Underhill said, for lack of attention, 1,000 forms of loveliness elude us every day, that we just simply don't look at a lot of things.
That's beautiful. And I think that's the role of the artist. And artists, I think, are the most obvious example of synesthesics because they bring out those subtleties that other people don't see through the feeling. I mean, a great painting, you will feel what the artist is communicating through color and shape. You know, it's the feeling that comes through in the really great masterpieces.
Exactly. And to
communicate that is a great gift to others that evolve us. You're absolutely right. You talked about evolution. It seems like everything is pointing in that direction.
Well, I think you're right when you talk about great art, that just the experience of looking at great art and introducing us to this, you know, perception, this unique perception that we've never experienced before, it also elevates the person who looks at it. You know, it also helps the viewer to evolve. So in that way, yeah, I mean, artists kind of lift the consciousness of everyone, and they're able to do that because maybe they've been able to retain some uniqueness in their own consciousness.
So what can we do, I don't know if you've worked in that field, to help preserve this and to help encourage it? Because I think, you know, synesthesia needs to come out and say and be seen for what it is, what I think the creative evolution of a culture. I mean, what do you feel is possible to do?
I think it's probably good for all of us to really, really try to look at our own perceptions and what they really are. And sometimes it can help to say, you know what, to start with a word or name that has a particular emotion for you. You know, suppose you say the name of someone that you really love, for example. It could be your lover, it could be your child, it could be your best friend. What are you experiencing when you say that name? What is coming into your mind? Is it something visual? Is it something that you hear?
Mm-hmm.
If it's something you hear, what are you hearing? Is it a voice? If it's a voice, whose voice is it? If it's something you're visualizing, what is it you're visualizing? You know, what is it that, how are you experiencing this, this emotion and this other person in a way that no one else in the world can? I think focusing on, you know, what is really unique about your perceptions? I think this is really what we all need to do, is really to know ourselves.
And it makes us more human, our capacity to feel more.
Absolutely. And to feel, and to know that there's a quality to our feeling that is unlike, you know, the quality of that feeling that anyone else might be experiencing. There's something very, you know, there's something completely unique about your experience.
Well, they do use this in healing work. I think Helena Rubinstein in her work would say, okay, what does the pain look like? What color does it have?
Yes, exactly.
And that's
exactly.
The thing. That's a form
I think
of sin. So,
yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, asking yourself, how am I experiencing this pain right now?
Uh-huh.
You know, how am I, what is it? What, if the pain has a color, what color is it? If it has a shape, what shape is it? Is it
right.
Big? Is it small? Is it, but just how are you experiencing it as distinct maybe from anyone else?
Well, it's like even colors. I can almost taste some colors, and maybe the things that oranges are orange and taste orange, and maybe that's what orange, the color itself, tastes like, an orange, you know?
Mm-hmm.
That's just something that just came to me. Their colors have tastes, and if you could ask someone what is blue taste like,
mm-hmm.
they could start to create those neural pathways in their mind that open up more creativity. So.
That could very well be, you know, maybe stretching and, you know, stretching
yeah.
and going in directions that we wouldn't normally go in.
Well, like you said, a lot of people are in the creative arts who have this ability.
Mm-hmm.
So they've developed, I think, a neural pathway between the senses that we could develop and make everyone more creative by asking them, okay, What does you know, pink sound like, or what, you know, just playing with that, you know, is just would be a fun creative exercise probably for children, and maybe they have that. So where's your research taking you now in this field?
Okay, well, I'm interested in just interviewing people about their thought processes,
mm-hmm.
About, you know, the particular way. I think that each of us has our own personal code, our own personal, let's say, inner map of the world,
mm-hmm.
that is unlike any other inner map. And sometimes it's so second nature to us that we don't even realize there's something amazing about it. There's something great about it.
But it's
so
socially conditioned. I mean, just
well,
some
yes, there could be I guess we have, let's say we have two maps. Okay, one that's socially conditioned and one that's all our own. And
right.
sometimes the one that's all our own gets a little bit overshadowed. Overwhelmed by the one that's socially conditioned. But what I'm interested in is to what degree can we still experience the one that's all our own? And by really focusing on it, can we make it come into sharper focus so that we understand it better and so that we can bring that thing that's all our own and it's completely unique, we can somehow bring that out into the world.
And so we can all be recognized for our uniqueness and our...
Yeah, and we can all contribute something of that uniqueness in all different ways.
Well, I do think that's the role of artists, is to evolve the culture. And it's also like what William Blake said, the imagination is what's human in us.
Yes.
So I think that's a great project to encourage that and to, have that. I mean, where... does like just pure, I think the map, the private map, I think what I've been studying is creativity and perception, and do you feel like perception itself is a creative act somehow?
Oh, absolutely. I think that anytime any of us looks at the world, we're seeing a world that is unlike a world anyone has seen before. I mean, there's something different about the way each of us perceives the world. So yes, I would say anytime any of us looks at the world, this is an absolutely creative act. We're seeing it through a one-of-a-kind lens of neurons and experiences unlike any other lens. So
but there's
absolutely.
Right. But there's active creativity, and then there's this passive creativity in a sense where the world impacting on us, and I would say there's a form of active creativity where we're impacting on the world.
And you know, there's a constant interaction going on. I think that's true. I think that sometimes we get, you know, I think the main danger is to lose the sense of what is ours and what we can bring to the world and what we can contribute. And we get too caught up in rejecting our own personal perception, saying, oh, that doesn't mean anything. That's silly. That's stupid. I have to sort of be like all these other perceptions. I have to sort of figure out what everybody else is perceiving and try to do the same thing.
Right.
I think
that's brainwashing. That's awful.
Exactly. I mean, I think we have to become more conscious of what we're doing. That we say, okay, there may be some survival reasons to sometimes to just take on the shared code, but don't ever confuse it with your own personal code, which is beautiful and unique, and you don't
right.
want to lose it. And, you know, going back to something you said earlier about stretching ourselves and realizing we have other capacities, there was a very interesting study done at the University of California at Irvine with meditation and synesthesia, that they found that people in very deep states of meditation, people who achieve very deep states of meditation, were able to have synesthetic experiences, even though they didn't normally have them in their normal state of mind. So if they were in very deep states of meditation, words might suddenly take on color, or music might suddenly take on color and shape. So again, you know, going back to the point you made earlier about many of us having this capacity, but we just have to kind of reach into ourselves, you know, deeply enough to get it and to activate it.
Well, is there then some kind of mystical element you found with this, or a spiritual awakening that happens in these perceptions?
Well, I think that, you know, a lot of people have definitely taken that approach to synesthesia, and really believe that it represents a kind of opening to some transcendent realm.
Who did? Who believed that?
I think certainly, Madame Blavatsky believed that. I think the circle of French symbolist poets believed that, like Rimbaud and Baudelaire. Rimbaud was so fascinated by synesthetic perception, and he was so convinced that it represented a link to some higher realm. He wrote a poem called The Sonnet of the Vowels, where he celebrates the colors of the vowels. And we know that Baudelaire also, talks about landscapes of lace. You know, he had lots of synesthetic perceptions when he was had his various drug experiences. But he did believe that this connected him in some way to a transcendent realm. And he also believed that people, as did Rimbaud, that people who had these experiences naturally, natural synesthetes, were already connected to some more transcendent realm. So certainly that belief is out there. I don't think it's everybody's interpretation of synesthesia, but that link has definitely been made.
To the mystical realms of, I've been studying that kind of symbolist period, and they did start to gear towards abstraction, abstract art, which is sort of a synesthetic experience. When you look at these non-representational canvases, you just get an impression that hits you, because you don't know, there's nothing to grab onto except the color and shape, and yet you can come away with some feeling about what you're seeing. So that's interesting that the symbolists really were the first to really create that awareness of perception, right? I mean, would you say it, or did it go back to the Greeks? Is its early origin, or maybe even people like Leonardo da Vinci had some kind of form of that? Is there any studies on that?
An interesting question. I don't know, but I do think that this color sound link was made very, very far back. I mean, I think even among the ancient Greeks, that connection was made. That what is the connection between color and sound? Is there a level on which one is an aspect of the other, and there is a kind of absolute connection?
Or maybe Pythagoras, in his understanding of music and mathematics, probably had some synesthetic. So my thing is, I think it's these people who bring these ideas forth do evolve the culture, do evolve consciousness and awareness, and who we are, and understanding new realities is gaining greater and greater awareness of ourselves.
Yeah. No, I think exactly. I think it's good for us to realize, we're always hearing how we use very little of our brain capacity, right? That we use 10% of our brain capacity. So, I mean, this indicates that there's so much there to be explored and to be used. It's almost like when you have a computer, and maybe the computer has so many programs in it, and it's got so much capacity to do so many different things, but maybe you've only learned to use one computer program, and you kind of just ignore all the others.
That's
Even with that one computer program, you've only learned how to use a couple of its functions, and you don't even go, you don't even try to learn. It seems kind of scary and too hard to figure out how to use all the other ones. So I think that's a kind of a metaphor for the way our brains are.
No, I use that metaphor. You're absolutely right. Most people just use one program to write something, and there's so much capacity that they just lies dormant. And how do we start to open up those parts of our brain that have these other programs? What would you say? I mean,
I think by paying attention in a way. I mean, to just trying to really kind of look at that unique internal map that we have, stretching ourselves in some way. You mentioned some exercises before, if you wanted to kind of really look at pain that you're feeling, if that pain, how are you experiencing that pain, and what makes it unpleasant for you? What exactly is it? Does that pain have a shape that you don't like? Does it have a color that you don't like? Does it have a, you know, what is it that makes it different from a pleasant sensation? Maybe just really looking at what it is we're experiencing and exactly how we're experiencing it. I think that is the place to begin. That's the place to begin, looking very carefully at your own experience so it doesn't just sort of go by and you're not quite conscious of it. And, you know, I mean, who was it who said the unexamined life is not worth living?
Who was that?
So, you know, I'm trying to remember, actually. But it's an important, whoever said it, it's an important idea. So I think we want to kind of really examine our own experience and really feel our own experience, be very aware of it.
I think honor experience, I think is really what you're saying. Honor the perceptions you have because they're unique and they're yours and they actually contribute to another human being when you share it.
Absolutely. Just as, you know, you mentioned before that artists kind of lift all of us up by showing us their beautiful and unique perceptions. And
giving us new perceptions,
Exactly. I mean, Kandinsky, you know, this whole idea of expressing sound in the colors and movements of his brushstrokes. And he does. I mean, if you look at a Kandinsky painting, you almost feel that you hear something. He somehow managed to capture that just in a totally visual medium. Okay, so how did he do that? He did that by really looking at what was his actual experience. His actual experience was that there was something linked about sound and sight, and he was just looking at his own experience and trying to represent that on a canvas and trying to get that across to others. And, you know, it revolutionized our perception.
Right. I mean, as you say that, I was thinking about dolphins and the study of dolphins where their sonar, their ability to send out sound, forms pictures in their mind. So their sounds are, you might want to look into dolphin perceptions.
I would like to do that,
Because that's how they communicate. So they send, this is what some researchers have said, I don't know if it's actually scientifically documented, but they supposedly or hypothesized that they send sound out, they get an image of the sound back as an echo reflection, then they're able to send that same sound to another dolphin, which is the image. So they're sending their sound, which becomes an image.
So you mean the other dolphin is actually receiving the image?
Through the sound, through the sonar.
That's fascinating.
Isn't that amazing?
Completely, completely fascinating.
Right, and they're more evolved than us anyway because they produce four sounds at once and they have this amazing sonar ability and these other perceptions that we don't have, dolphins. They are worth looking into in terms of this work.
I'm absolutely going to do that,
I mean, I don't know how much work. I did a film for a guy named John Lilly.
John Lilly, who did the sensory deprivation.
Yes, so he invented the sensory deprivation tank, and then he wanted to know, well, who floats around all day? And this guy said, well, go check out the dolphins. And, you know, he found they have bigger brains, they're more spherical, they still have a left and right side of the brain, but they seem to be more aware. Actually, they only sleep, but they don't sleep completely, only sleep on one side of their brain at a time because they have to be conscious breathers. So he's done amazing work. I mean, he's no longer alive, but he started to understand their form of communication and realized that, you know, there's these things happening between dolphins and the way they perceive reality. And there's other people who have taken up that work, but, you know, and whales, dolphins and whales, they create huge, I think, sonar fields and create images out of that. I think. We'll see. But I'd be like to know what you find out about that.
Well, that is completely fascinating. And you've brought up a lot of great areas for new research for everybody. I mean, for me and also for your listeners.
Oh, I know. I mean, I enjoy investigating areas of perception. That's what I feel like new realities is all about. I think it was Proust who said, new discoveries don't lie in finding new lands. It's in finding new eyes to perceive.
Very important. Very important idea.
that's where your work is also valuable, because you've acknowledged this as something that should be looked at and investigated.
Well, if any of your listeners mm-hmm. would like to find out more about synesthesia, let me recommend that they go to www.bluecats.info,
uh-huh.
and they will find the synesthesia, the Blue Cat Synesthesia Resource Center, with links to so many different articles and programs and videos on synesthesia, so that they can and also the synesthetic artists who are trying to express their synesthetic perceptions in their art, and people who paint music, for example, or people that try to paint even painful, literally painful sensations that they have, particular colors or shapes. So there's just, there's just a whole other universe out there of perception.
This is your website, bluecats.org?
This is my website, uh-huh. It's bluecats.info.
Bluecats.info.
Bluecats, one word. Mm-hmm. So www.bluecats.info. Mm-hmm. And that's where you'll get the Blue Cat Synesthesia Resource Center with so much information about synesthesia.
Do cats actually look blue to you? Is that where you get the blue cat?
Because the word cat is blue.
Oh.
And, the word for cat is blue. So when I was a little girl, I drew a picture for my father of, and it was called 50 Blue Cats for Dad. And it was this whole page full of blue cats.
Mm.
And I guess when I first gave it to him, he just thought, oh, well, children are imaginative. He probably didn't think too much about why the cats were blue. Mm. And then much later, I was having a conversation with my father, and this was the first time I realized that not everybody was experiencing words as having color. I mean, because most synesthetes just think everyone experiences
what
they do.
Of course.
Until one day you say something by accident, about the colors of words, and nobody knows what you're talking about, and then you realize, like, oh, you mean it's only me. So I was having a conversation with my father one day. I was 16 years old. This was back in the 1960s.
Mm-hmm.
And we were talking about the time I was a little girl, and he was teaching me to write the letters of the alphabet. And we remembered, during that conversation, we both remembered that I had trouble making the letter R. So then, during this conversation, I said, but, I realized one day that to make an R, all I had to do was draw a P and then draw an extra line coming down from the P loop. And I was so surprised I could change a yellow letter into an orange letter just by adding a line.
Mm.
And my father said, a yellow letter, an orange letter, what do you mean? And I said, well, you know, Dad, the colors of the letters. And he said, the colors of the letters? And that was the first time I realized that, this thing about experiencing alphabet letters in color and words in color wasn't something that most people didn't experience.
Wow.
I was very surprised. So
wow.
Then, we went on to talk about other things, and he remembered the drawing I had made for him, when I was a little girl. And I said, well, yeah, the word cat is blue.
I think they're giving us a signal to wrap up.
Okay.
But, it's interesting. So actually, it's probably all shapes. Maybe we'll do another show at some point.
Thank you so much, Alan. I've really enjoyed it, and I hope that your listeners will check out bluecats.info.
Definitely. I've been talking to Patricia Duffy, and you're in New York, aren't you?
Yes, I am.
Well, maybe we'll meet sometime. I'm in New York, too.
Okay. I hope so.
Okay.
I'll send you the book.
Thank you. This is Alan Steinfeld for New Realities, and you can check out my website with these talks and others at newrealities.com under podcasts, and also you can check out the BBS Radio archives. And I'm here every week. If you have any questions or comments, please email me at newrealities@earthlink.net. Thank you for listening, and hope to hear from you. And listen, next week I'll be interviewing Stanton Friedman, the founder of the Roswell UFO incident and a great UFO researcher. So Thank you, and good night.
Good night.
Good night.
$5,000 per week take you? Discover the exact details of a simple and proven system that quickly puts $5,000 to $10,000 in many students' pockets every week. What's most amazing is that there are almost no computer skills required, and you can start pulling in cash automatically within just a few hours. We are absolutely convinced that our proven system will create massive wealth for virtually anyone, and we'll prove it. Go to bbscashflow.com now and get all the details. That's bbscashflow.com.